Quero agradecer a todas as pessoas que estão aqui hoje e que vieram mais uma vez ao Human Entities. É para nós uma enorme satisfação continuar a fazer este programa aqui e quero agradecer à Sofia e ao Jared por continuarem a fazer aqui. Na verdade, vocês podiam fazer isto em qualquer lado, mas continuam a escolher a Trianal e nós ficamos muito felizes por isso. I would like to thank Sofia and Jared to keep doing this program here, because actually they could do it anywhere and they still believe that this is the best place to do it. So I'm happy that they're still choosing us. And actually I shouldn't say this too often, otherwise they might leave. Anyway, it looks like less than a year. It's actually less than a year, but it was so short that we were here in November last year, and we are here again. I'm very happy that I don't have to ask you to keep your masks on, as I did for the past edition, so you can breathe. You can actually breathe. I would still ask you to smoke back there if you want to smoke, but you don't need to have your masks on. Eu estava a dizer que para usarem as máscaras, para não usarem as máscaras, ou não têm que usar máscaras, mas podem usá-las naturalmente, e se quiserem fumar, para irem até lá atrás e não fumarem nos lugares onde estão. E é só isso, o resto vai ser apresentado pela Sofia. Eu vim aqui só agradecer-vos em nome da Trianal de Arquitetura e agradecer também a quem vem falar hoje. Parece que vamos ter uma audiência, não é? Como são advogados, parece que vamos ter uma audiência de tribunal.
Hello. I'm going to switch to English. Apologies, because this is an international event. So welcome to the fifth edition of Human Entities, and thank you so much for coming. It's a real pleasure to be able to do cultural programming again face to face and sharing the same physical space. The reason why we do Human Entities is because we really want to create a discussion space, and we believe that that's much better than out of the Zoom sofa. So we're Kada, I'm Sofia Oliveira, this is Jared Hockey, and as organizers of this event, we must thank the DG Arts for its financial support. Kada would also like to thank our amazing partner, the Lisbon Architecture Trianal, for hosting and promoting the event. And we're also especially grateful to our supporters, Lisbon City Council and Professor Nuno Correia at Nova Links, Universidade Nova de Lisboa. We must also thank Chloe Gastin, who works with CADA and was involved in the research of the program. And finally, Inês Cisneiros, Eduardo Santos and João Leite for accepting our invitation to participate. So, in April this year, the European Union published the world's first proposal for regulating artificial intelligence. And in response, CADA decided to organize this evening's event to celebrate this moment of historical importance. With this proposal, what the EU is effectively saying is that real technological advance depends on respect for fundamental human rights. So this is a very ambitious task. But despite difficulties, which include definitions that are unclear, missing, or simply wrong, implementation problems due to the complexity and opacity of AI algorithms, and the criticism it has received from citizens and human rights groups, industry, the market, academia, and so on, so everybody has been criticizing this proposal is still a landmark, because it's clear that, at last, politicians have understood there is a problem to be solved. So from now on, the risks associated with AI are no longer a matter of personal opinion, no longer just the views of paranoid guests at dinner parties, no longer the preserve of those who are against the technology, Now, politicians in Europe are also saying there are societal risks with artificial intelligence per se. So, to stimulate these debates, we have invited Inês Cisneiros, a practicing lawyer, to provide an overview of the proposal for us. Following this, there'll be a roundtable discussion with two experts, Eduardo Santos, who's the president of the association D3, aimed to protect digital rights, and João Leite, associate professor of computer science department, Nova University of Lisbon. So, Inês Cisneiros is a practicing lawyer at Miranda and Associados and an elected member of the deliberative body of the Portuguese Green Party, LIVRE. She holds postgraduate qualifications in intellectual property, information society, data protection and bioethics, and is currently completing a master's degree in political philosophy at the School of Social Sciences and Humanities of Nova University. Her master's dissertation will focus on issues regarding democratic engagement across generations, touching on the political impacts of technology. Thank you, Inês, Eduardo, and João, for accepting our invitation.
Hi. Thank you, Sofia. So, good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for this talk on the European Union's regulatory framework for artificial intelligence, more specifically on the proposal of the European Commission for AI regulation. I'd also like to thank Sofia and Jared from CADA for challenging me to prepare this presentation. So, apparently Sofia noticed me in an academic event while I was bugging a member of the AI high-level experts group and decided to trust my ability to problematize, which is indeed one attribute that I'm assigned or even called on frequently. But that certainly becomes more interesting when accompanied by some sort of potential solutions, which I don't know if I can right now offer, but I'll try to share with you my thoughts. Not only legal, but also philosophical and political. So I did delve into AI matters last year and wrote about a couple of topics for a master's seminar on practical ethics, mainly because of this universal driver called FOMO, or the fear of missing out. So the same one that keeps us online, basically. The sensation that there is something important going on that we may not be aware of or comprehend in its entirety. It was a black hole that I felt I needed to explore, and indeed, there were already a galaxy of problems in orbit. And a lot of them are already changing life on Earth, meaning society as we know it. But the fact that the technical dimension of it makes it very abstract, and without the adequate literacy, it is easy to ignore them until it pinches us directly, and then it may be too late. So I'd also like to thank Professor João Leite and Eduardo Santos for their work in these areas and for accepting to helping me in this attempt to share or communicate some of the most urgent topics regarding the regulation of artificial intelligence in the European Union. It will not be possible for us to be exhaustive, but we have a lot to say, and we know we'll not be able to cover it all. So please ask us questions in the end, and excuse me for the fact that I will be reading a bit during this first part. Should I use any technical jargon in the wrong way, Professor João, please correct me. So without further ado, I'd like to go back a little before analyzing the European Commission proposal, so please bear with me. I'm going to try to cover a brief introduction, short history note and social media, most common social media applications, digital economy and other current applications, a bit of a comparative legal note, and then a delve into the European Commission proposal. So The history of AI, short term for artificial intelligence, has been developed upon hype cycles ever since the 60s, alternatively responding to the enthusiasm caused by overly ambitious or unrealistic promises by prominent AI scientists and commercial vendors, as well as to the disappointment and pessimism in the community and in the press whenever such promises were not immediately fulfilled. They are usually followed by winters, meaning periods marked by severe cutback in funding and research. During these periods, namely in the mid-2000s, after the Y2K scare, many researchers in AI deliberately called their work by other names, namely informatics, machine learning, analytics, and some other, to indicate that their work emphasized particular tools or was directed at a particular sub-problem. So being more forward about its limitations and avoiding the stigma of false promises attached to the name of artificial intelligence. Language translation, in particular Google Translate, image recognition, and some game-playing systems are to blame for having been successful developed and for what we now call this current AI spring, so following the winter. Changes in the main sources of funding can also be noticed in this context, as it is no longer dependent on political choices, but rather the political choices are having to move along technological development that is carried out by private agents. So many advances can be noticed since the 2010, which sort of coincides with social media advent. Indeed, these may even be artificial intelligence applications that are more familiar to us all. For example, across all social media platforms, in each social media post, an artificial intelligence algorithm or machine learning systems is regulating how the content we create and the ads we may be buying are placed in front of other users, often in ways that aren't entirely transparent. So recommendation engines collect data on the content we engage with in social media. So from pinning a picture on Pinterest to commenting on an Instagram post, and then they display the material that they anticipate we will enjoy. Facebook uses advanced machine learning to do everything from serve you content to recognize your face in photos, to target users with advertising. And Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, uses AI to identify visuals and tailor layouts for marketing purposes. LinkedIn uses AI to offer job recommendations, suggest people you might like to connect with, and serves you specific posts in your feed. Along with these recommendation engines, chatbots conduct conversations via auditory or textual methods and facilitate communication between consumers and businesses, being programmed to respond immediately to inquiries, saving time and enhancing overall customer experience. And I put a question mark in front of it because I don't know any of us feel satisfied whenever talking to a chatbot. But social media bots are artificial intelligence tools that target and respond to specific groups that can influence the results of our marketing efforts eventually. One of the most important functions of social media bots is to sort and filter groups on social media so there are a team can find relevant audiences that will respond to a brand, for example. Conversely, the same bots can be used to block users and groups that either don't fit or don't respond to our brand. And when we talk about brands, we can talk about like a specific interest group, for example, which happens a lot on Twitter with some politic hashtags or something like that, or merely other topics. Along with these AI applications, so facial recognition, when we post a group photo on Facebook, most of the faces in the photo are identified and automatically tagged with the help of facial recognition technology. It requires multiple layers of neural networks, which use machine learning to identify the components of an object, in this case, facial features. Also, some social media apps like Snapchat and Line offer animated lenses and filters that use facial recognition to change in real time the appearance of the of its users. This is also being used to alter content, namely producing what we know as deepfakes, and that is not always easy for the naked eye to identify. So AI often operates behind the scenes of popular platforms and entirely at the discretion of the company that owns the platform. But to join these, we usually are provided with applicable terms and conditions that we have to accept to use the platform. And many features are adjustable in spite of their increasing complexity and user unfriendliness. These uses are supposed to have been authorized by us for the purpose of joining a specific network. But are we truly aware of what we have authorized? Since 2018, access to our personal data is regulated by the GDPR, precisely because it is what feeds AI applications and the dematerialization of commerce. Data is currency because it helps companies target ads towards our preferences, and it is deemed that our consent is required for that purpose, namely in the form of accepting cookies that track our moves in each website. In fact, given that such tailoring procedures cause what is called a bubble effect, where our preferences, tastes, and beliefs are positively reinforced, a Plato's cave allegory can ensue, and we need to be aware of these implications because our consent will be asked, and for our own good, we should not merely provide it formally. Consent, per definition, requires information or knowledge about what we are consenting on, and not merely volition or will. So things get more serious when we consider blunt cases of abusive use, such as that of Cambridge Analytica, for example. So even if the collection of data complies with GDPR rules and you have provided consent, there are cases where the consequent use of your data is not explicit. So it is obvious how AI used by social networks and online platforms may alter our perception of reality, social and political dynamics, feeding polarization and making democracies vulnerable. This is just a case study, the case of, for example, Cambridge Analytica, that can easily support the need for regulation of AI as a tool. But current AI applications can actually be found in every sector, and therefore problems such as algorithm bias, opacity, complexity, and unpredictability are also a risk. So AI has been used to develop and advance numerous fields and industries, including finance, healthcare, education, transportation, and more. It can be found in almost every major technology and is being utilized for a wide range of activities, including medical diagnosis, electronic trading platforms, robot control, and remote sensing. When we talk about remote control, not necessarily an anthropomorphized robot, but, for example, automated cars is a very hot example right now. So it is a staple of the new industrial era that prioritizes efficient logistics over human error. More than a new production factor of production, AI is seen as a new factor of growth. It is also seen as essential to tackle climate challenges, allowing to dematerialize work, reduce waste of resources, and make education more inclusive. Further, resistance to the uptake of AI or mere delays will make administrations and businesses obsolete, with significant economical and developmental impacts. So there is a global race to see who's going to be established as world reference in this field. The United States started fostering this AI spring sooner, with the Obama administration issuing a strategic plan in 2016 to invest in AI research for fundamental areas that private investors don't usually focus that much. So public health, urban systems, social welfare, criminal justice, environmental sustainability, and national security were some of the main areas in which U.S. government was interested in investing in the field of AI. But the U.S. have been less active regarding matters of ethics, governance, and regulation, navigating a fairly liberal environment that allows each company to self-regulate by hiring and selling ethical and governance consultation and principles as a commodity or competition factor. International cooperation has been pointed out as essential by the Trump administration. I know, shocking. Not just because the U.S. requires our data, as the GDPR has created sort of an artificial scarcity of data for the U.S., but also because they should attract talent. And migration rules in the U.S., those that are enforced, may be an obstacle for this. But nevertheless, there is already a significant brain drain in Europe that can be observed where EU nationals are hired to work in the USA. So comparing to the U.S., China has been catching up, producing a significant amount of academic papers, where the U.S. actually scores in quality. It leads in paper publication, and its population represents a huge amount of data, obviously, and the government has strategic plans in place to catch up. But its civil-military integration causes distrust of other societies and maybe a competitive disadvantage. Responding to this, Shenzhen, which is a Chinese region equivalent to Silicon Valley, has recently adopted a local legal instrument. So on June 28th, Shenzhen promulgated the draft of the regulations on the promotion of artificial intelligence industry of Shenzhen's special economic zone. This instrument seeks to establish an overarching framework for AI, such as the approval framework for marketing entrance of AI products and services. It contemplates ethical aspects, but there is generalized skepticism towards it, given that government interests usually prevail. The social credit system is seen as one of the worst examples of it. But the country has also developed advanced facial recognition systems that are able to follow people across entire cities. And more worryingly, in the region of Xinjiang, in the northwest of the country, it has become a test bed for China's vast digital control operations. In particular, the largely Muslim minority of the Uyghur people have been subjected to increased surveillance and discrimination. It has been uncovered that more than 500,000 face scans of Uyghurs have been conducted. So, moving on to the European Union's approach. So how did this proposal happen, and where are we at? So in the context of this global race, the European Council called in 2017 for a sense of urgency to address emerging trends, and I'm quoting, including issues such as artificial intelligence, while at the same time ensuring a high level of data protection, digital rights, and ethical standards. In 2018, European Commission set a high-level expert group on AI, which had an inclusive and broad composition of 52 well-known experts tasked to advise the Commission on the implementation of the Commission's strategy on artificial intelligence. On April 2019, the Commission supported the key requirements set out in the high-level experts group ethic guidelines for trustworthy AI, which had been revised to take into account more than 500 submissions from stakeholders. An online public consultation was launched on 19 February 2020, along with the publication of the white paper on artificial intelligence. And this public consultation ran until 14 June last year. The objective of such consultation was to collect views and opinions on the white paper published in 2020. The proposal, European Commission's proposal for the regulation of AI, builds on 2 years of analysis and close involvement of stakeholders, including academics, businesses, social partners, non-governmental organizations, member states, and citizens. It was presented in April 2021 and is currently being discussed between the European Parliament and the Council, which may from which dialogue some amendments may surge. And this is the interesting part, because since today we will be pointing out some critics, it is good to know that some change may still occur. So the Directorate General of the European Commission that is in charge of this document, the DG Connect, they stated that it will not be approved this year. So there's still lots of time until this comes into force. Why is this proposal important? So by presenting this proposal, the European Commission is using the same strategy as it did with the GDPR, presenting itself as a leader in innovation that stands out among its competitors because it stands for ethical principles that will attest to the quality of its products. What will be served in and by the single European digital market is trustworthiness, both encompassing the trust of providers towards legal rules and compliance procedures that are equal in all European Union, and consumers' trusts that have minimum guarantees of what type of product they're buying or hiring. This has major potential to influence international practices, as the GDPR did. What does it propose? So, attached to the European Commission proposal, it was an explanatory memorandum that established that the primary purpose of the Artificial Intelligence Act would be to implement the second objective of the European Commission's white paper of 2020. So for the development of an ecosystem of trust by addressing the risks associated with certain uses of technology based on European Union values and fundamental rights. The memorandum continues that this is separate from the Commission's aim to promote the uptake of AI, which, while important, is not the main goal of this act. The four specific objectives which the memorandum describes are also aligned with the ambition of trustworthy AI. So safety and respect for fundamental rights, legal certainty, enhanced governance and enforcement of safety and fundamental rights, and a lawful, safe and trustworthy single market. Despite this reassurance, the Artificial Intelligence Act proposal seems at its core designed to enable AI uptake rather than to limit or mitigate its harms. This is a critic pointed out by the European Digital Rights Association, EDRI, which is sort of a sister of Eduardo Santos' own association, but an European sister. And so the Commission explicitly admits that this is a minimum necessary approach, and it is at odds with EU fundamental rights obligations. It also contradicts the precautionary principle, which civil society has warned is necessary given the vast contextual harms which may arise from the use of AI systems to which people are subject. The regulation lays down harmonized rules for the placing on the market, putting into service and use of artificial intelligence systems in the Union. It prohibits certain artificial intelligence practices. It imposes specific requirements for high-risk AI system and obligations for operators of such systems, and harmonized transparency rules for AI systems intended to interact with natural persons, emotional recognition systems, and biometric categorization systems, and AI systems used to generate or manipulate image, audio, or video content, those we know as deepfakes. It also establishes rules on market monitoring and surveillance. So, regarding scope, the regulation specifically applies, and this is very interesting, not only to providers placing on the market or putting into service AI systems in the Union, irrespectively of whether those providers are established within the European Union or in a third country. It also applies to users of AI systems located within the Union. This is normal. But also to providers and users of AI systems that are located in third countries where the output produced by the system is used in the Union. So the criterion is that the output of these AI systems, if it's being used in the European Union territory, then it is subject to this law. It doesn't matter that its manufacturer is located outside the Union. Again, this is a bit of the GDPR tactics, which is, so if you want to trade with the European Union, you have to abide by the European Union rules. And so comply with these maximum limits that this proposal is trying to establish. And these are maximum limits, and there is a lot of critics that can be done regarding it, because then a lot of things can pass through it still. But first of all, as we saw, it is still something that not every country is available to do. So limiting its industry. Again, in the United States, there are sort of like corporate self-regulation, and things just go from bottom up, and actually imposing limitations top down always gets in tension with the freedom to create new products and to innovate and to research, obviously. So there are some trade-offs that definitely have to be considered. So this proposal offers a very broad definition of AI, which I personally think it's good, but I know Professor Jean has its own opinions. We could check. I'm sorry, my computer froze. Yeah, I know. Yeah. So, without delving into the definitions itself, one of the most interesting things of this regulation or this proposal is precisely the prohibited uses. So, if Eduardo wants to mention some of them, go ahead.
Good evening. I'm Eduardo Sanch. I'm a lawyer. I'm not an AI expert, so allow me to give you some context on why I'm here. I'm here as a civil society representative. I'm heading Digital Decree, a digital rights organization in Portugal. Digital rights being understood as fundamental rights that we know, but in a technological context. So whenever issues come up that involve technology and digital and fundamental rights, we cover many different issues such as net neutrality, privacy, encryption, e-vote, data retention. It's a really wide scope. We are part, as Inês said, of EDRI, the European Digital Network, the European Digital Rights Network, which is composed of 45 digital NGOs. And in the context of this network, we have been following the AI proposal from the Commission. Allow me to show you our general feelings and some thoughts on that. A piece of warning first. It's a proposal, and Sophia said there have been so many criticism on the proposal. At this stage, that's a very good thing. So it means that the proposal will get better, and the text will change. Not necessarily for good, but let's believe so. It will be better than it is now. So why do we care? The AI systems, basically, they enable mass surveillance and intrusion into our personal lives if they are not regulated properly. They can reinforce social inequalities, and they can shift more power into corporate hands and disrupt the democratic process. So my point here is not to scare you, but we all know that AI is a recipe for great things, but it's also a recipe for disaster. I'm sure no one here dreams to have a social score system like they have in China. So regulation does matter. On the positive side of things, we believe that the EU did the right thing, trying to step ahead and regulate AI. So, as Inês mentioned, they are trying to use what is now called the Brussels effect that we saw with GDPR, which is, as the EU was the first one to regulate and have a great framework, they can influence the rest of the world. For example, we saw Brazil coping our GDPR to its own law. And that happened on other many other countries as well. GDPR is now the main reference in the world for the privacy and data protection legislation. I agree that we won't all agree that this is a positive thing, because yes, there will probably be a price to be paid in terms of competition. So maybe João will talk about it. I'm not sure, but there are consequences to this. Some brains that escape to other jurisdictions, and maybe our companies will have more trouble to keep talent here within our borders. Another positive thing about this framework is how the approach they divided their approach in several levels. So depending on the risk of the AI practice. So that's a very positive thing. And we don't need horizontal rules on this area. As a negative, the most interesting part for us, or for me, it's the Article 5. And to discuss Article 5, it's the prohibited AI practices. So the European Commission does admit there are practices that are not acceptable, and that is in principle a good thing. So at least now That is very clear, as Sophia mentioned. So the question now becomes, we have a proposal, but the proposal will change. The final outcome, it's very hard to predict, but there will be a long legislative process and lots of lobbying. So we do have this tailored approach, but the final outcome, if it's positive or negative, it will depend a lot on how the legislative process will evolve. It will depend a lot on lobbying and what are the priorities for the lawmakers. In our view, the most important part of this legislation for us is the use of biometric technologies, use of real-time biometric systems. So I don't want to focus too much on the text of the law, because it will change and it's a bit boring, but if you read the Article 5, you will find several problems with it. For example, it says that the usage of biometric technologies is prohibited when deployed by law enforcement, such as police using... this doesn't say, but it's prohibited when deployed by law enforcement, which it sounds great for us, in our opinion at least. But then you will find, and unless if strictly necessary, and then you will find some cases when it can be considered strictly necessary. This prohibition is also thin and comes with exceptions. And exceptions can be abused. I say thin because why only law enforcement, for example? What about other cases? Shouldn't we ban as well these systems when used by schools, local governments, or even private companies? As such practice can perpetuate harmful stereotypes, I believe we would like to see in the following months, we would like to add more to the list of prohibited practices, such as predictive policing and automated recognition of sensitive identity traits like race, gender identity, and disabilities. So, yeah, we predict that this will be the main discussions on the following months. We hope that the lawmakers can reject the idea that some forms of remote biometric identification are permissible and others are impermissible. So, we would hope for a full prohibition on all forms of biometric mass surveillance practices in publicly accessible spaces like this one, even if it's private, by all public authorities and private actors. In this, we are not alone. Let me go to the European Data Protection Supervisor. He says, a stricter approach is necessary, given that remote biometric identification presents extremely high risks of deep and non-democratic intrusion into individuals' private lives. As a final note, let me just introduce you to a campaign that Adris is running right now. It's the Reclaim Your Face campaign. You can find more information on reclaimyourface.eu. The end goal is to ban biometric mass surveillance, whatever the type is. So if you agree, I would like to invite you to go to the website and sign it. It's an official petition to the EU Parliament, which are called European Citizens Initiatives. It will ask your data a lot of it. Don't blame the EU or the EU Parliament. The data it asks you depends on your national country and national law. With it, I'm finished. Thank you.
Okay, so if you agree that biometrical identification in public spaces should be forbidden, go to Google, reclaim your face, right? .eu, and sign the petition. And again, the fact that the European Data Protection Office, or supervisor, is already against it, it shows good prospects regarding, you know, this being one of the things that will be changed. So, what is lacking for us to know is what will fall in the end onto these prohibited practices, since there are a lot of exceptions, to the ones that are already, foreseen. And it's, so for example, one of the exceptions of these biometrical recognition in public spaces. So you have, I don't know if you all know what this is. So basic cameras located in the street that will identify your face or your facial features and know who you are and associate this information with, for example, your your records, it will associate not just identify who you are, it will associate it with information on you. Just like the Chinese government does. So, this is obviously deemed as intrusive. One of the curious things about this proposal is that, it says that it is so, usually a prohibited practice, but then it provides, some considerable exceptions. So, for example, it is authorized by enforcement authorities whenever they're searching for example, a kidnapped kid or a terrorist group or that they know will soon be, for example, trying to do a terrorist attack. And the problem with this is that it usually requires an authorization by public authorities, but there is also an exception for this requirement. So it reminds us of a Portuguese sketch that was done on abortion. So it was prohibited, but you can do it, right? This is the same here. So public authorities and enforcement agent, law enforcement agents can allege that there was this urgent factor accounting to for them to dismiss the requirement of the authorization to go ahead and put biometrical identification plugins in cameras on the street, for example. There's a lot that can be allowed by these alleged prohibited practices. Another thing that we will want to know is what will fall into the risk assessment criteria. So which technologies will be required specific obligations of their providers. It's right now the interesting thing about these high risk AI is that it is mainly decided considering the uses of the artificial intelligence. Namely when applying specific AI systems to, again, biometrical identification and categorization of natural persons, management and operation of critical infrastructure, education and vocational training. So namely to, for example, get your kid into school or something like that. And employment, workers management and access to self-employment, access and enjoyment of essential private services and public services and benefits, law enforcement and administration of justice and the democratic process. So these are some of the uses of specific technologies that are deemed as high risk and therefore require of their providers. For example, so not only testing prior into the putting into the market or the putting into service, and also sort of follow-ups. And I will stop talking again and ask Professor João if he wants to share with us what excites him and what scares him in this proposal.
Okay, so thank you, first of all, for inviting me to this event. Having worked in artificial intelligence for over 25 years, both in teaching and doing scientific research, it's always a pleasure for me to talk about this topic. So a very recent survey showed that the level of adoption of artificial intelligence in Europe is significantly lower than by European citizens than by their US and Chinese counterparts. And they systematically mention a lack of trust in AI systems as the reason for their lack of adoption. So I personally, and many in my field share this thought with me, that AI in itself is not the devil, and certainly not just because it needs to be legislated, should be regarded as some evil technology. AI has proved to be good for citizens, for businesses, for the public interests. But of course, it creates some risks for the safety of consumers and users, and chief of all, to the fundamental rights of humans. And so I'm quite happy and glad that the European Union is leading this journey of regulating artificial intelligence, namely to as a way to set the standard for what the European Union wants trustworthy AI to be, which will hopefully have consequences all over the world, and others will follow us. This document is quite rich. It takes time to fully understand its consequences, and my guess is that we will only fully understand the consequences of the document substantially sometime after it comes into practice. However, it's set up in a way that's quite good at giving clarity to citizens and to the industry regarding what is acceptable and what is not acceptable when it comes to AI-based systems. But it's not easy to do such a document. I mean, it's not the first time, even over the last 2 years, it's not the first time that people think about regulating AI and how it could be done. And we all know that it's a very difficult challenge, certainly because you don't want to overregulate it in a way that the good elements of AI are thrown away with the regulation. And when reading the documents, I see many positive aspects and, of course, some reservations. And I think just about everyone that I know from different fields, everyone has the same opinion about the document, in the sense that some of it is good, some of it is bad, but no one kind of agrees on what are the good parts and the bad parts, okay? So I'll give you some of the things that I like about this particular document, and then I'll mention some of the reservations that I see when I read it, hopefully setting up the floor for some debate with your participation. So the first good thing about this document, the last version that was published, is I don't think you want to regulate artificial intelligence, but rather regulate the systems, use cases, and what they do. Okay? The problem is not in the technology itself, it's where you use it from. It's wrong to use it to categorize children. But the same system that can be used to categorize children can be used, I don't know, in medical domains for very good things. Okay? So that was one of the fears before this document was produced, that the legislators would set up to regulate AI. But it's good that they listened to a lot of people throughout the last 2 years. And in the end, they set up a document that regulates the use cases, what the system aims to do, and not the AI on its own, because there are many good things that AI can help with. The other good thing about this system is to really classify the use of AI along different risk levels, okay? Because certainly the same technology can be used for something which is completely harmless, okay? But it can also create very severe risks for human rights, for example. And so it's good to have a legislation that is flexible enough that each particular use can be classified as forbidden, high risk, low risk, or no risk at all, because this again gives flexibility to allow for the developments and for new companies to use and adopt some of these technologies for things which are completely harmless, but at the same time put severe burden on the other high risk cases. So I really like this idea of having four levels of risks associated with the legislation. And in particular, I like the very firm red lines that it puts on what is forbidden. Okay. We can argue, and this is going to be an online discussion for the next few months, what should be on that top level of forbidden things. But the very fact that there is a list which can be maintained and which can contain the things that society deems as being forbidden and not acceptable is there. It's already foreseen, and I like that particular aspect. Okay. I also like the fact that it puts emphasis on trust and transparency. Okay. So more than forbidding certain things. No, it just wants them to be transparent, to be trustful, okay? Trustful of the way the system was developed, of what the system intends to do, instead of just allowing or forbidding. And a very interesting point of the legislation is that it puts this emphasis on trust and transparency of the entire ecosystem and not just the provider or the developer of AI. There are also certain places where it puts the burden on the user. The user is supposed to use the systems in the way they were supposed to be used. Because sometimes it's not the technology that's high risk. Sometimes it's the use that people give it that was not intended that make it a bad thing. So one example, maybe some of you are aware of it, YouTube at some point, I mean, YouTube has a recommender system and a comment section associated with the videos, which by itself having the comment section is harmless. Okay. And the recommender system just to recommend other videos might also be not particularly problematic. Okay. But for example, this was being exploited in videos aimed at children and they were playing gaming, the recommender system to have children be diverted from those videos and linked to other videos, which would then incite them to undertake harmful practices. Okay. So this is an example where certainly it was the comment section in the very simple recommender system that on its own, it's not high risk, but its use was. Okay. Anyway, YouTube shut down these systems for children's videos. Okay. So these are some of the things that I like. This idea of putting the emphasis on trust and transparency and on the uses rather than on the technology. But again, there are also some problems with this law. Sophia mentioned it on her introduction that, yes, everybody is complaining about some parts of the law. I'll tell you two or three of the ones that worry me in particular. And the first one has to do, I know it sometimes may seem a bit, misplaced to discuss this issue, but the very definition of what artificial intelligence is, okay? In people working in this from many decades, we tried to come up with a definition and we gave up at some point because we realized that it's such an open topic, such an evolving, constantly fast evolving topic that we cannot just place, we cannot have a very defined, well-defined concept of what AI is that doesn't exclude things which should be included and includes things that should be excluded. Okay. Whereas for the scientific community, that was not a problem. So at some point, you just saw the community no longer discussing what AI is. Everybody had some kind of intuitive, more or less well-defined understanding of what AI was, and that was enough for us to go about our lives. But if you are legislating, things are not as like that. You cannot, my colleagues from the law area of the world will know this better than me, but it's very problematic when you build a piece of legislation on top of a definition which is to many people incomplete, undefined, and sometimes even contradictory in some aspects. Okay. And this might seem like a very small thing, but I expect the next few months that this will be at the very center of the discussion. Okay. And the problem is that for people who have, the right kind of ideals or of values, these things are never really problematic. But the thing is that these definitions can be exploited by malicious companies to circumvent the legislation. Okay. I'll give you an example so that it becomes clear what I mean by this. So, for example, this definition lists a particular set of technologies. Okay. So AI is something that uses technology A, B, C, and D. Just to give you some names, for example, neural networks, expert systems, or whatever. Okay. And these are very well-defined technologies that indeed are at the basis of many of these AI systems. But a company wanting to circumvent this could easily come up with a technology that was different than this, but like isomorphic, similar, but with a different name, and suddenly it's excluded from the law. Okay. So this is just to show you one of the problems of why having these definitions matters. Okay. So personally, I would have preferred the definition based on what the system does rather than the technology underlying it. But anyway, this would also create problems elsewhere. So I'm just saying that this is going to be one of the key aspects of this legislation. Okay. And maybe, or likely even more than maybe, likely we will pass the legislation with some definition, and over the years we'll see where it goes wrong, where it goes right, and hopefully we'll improve it over the years. I think that's probably what's going to happen. Another thing that concerns me, and I will not take much more time, has to do with the requirement that when you read it, it sounds as if, of course, it should be there. That's the obvious gut response when you read it. But it's going to create all sorts of problems, which is a requirement that data sets, that sometimes these systems use huge amounts of data to be trained, data sets must be free of errors and complete. Okay? First, if you ask any scientists, any data scientist, any AI practitioner, he or she will tell you that first, they don't even understand exactly what it means to be free of errors. A data set is a data set. It's almost incomplete by nature. It's flawed by nature, okay? Because the sensors that capture the data are not perfect for all sorts of reasons. So this idea of free of errors is something that doesn't exist in the real world, or only in very well-tailored, very specific cases, you could say that a particular data set is complete. Otherwise, you can't. But it's quite interesting because it seems to clash directly heads-on with the GDPR. Because I'll give you a quick example. So the GDPR, so imagine that we're talking about the data set containing information about all of you, okay? For it to be complete, it will have to have information about every single one of you. But at the same time, the GDPR gives you the right to be forgotten, okay? So you can tell me, I want you to forget me. And I am obliged, because of the GDPR, of eliminating all the data I have about you. So it means that after complying with the GDPR, then the data set is no longer complete. So I can no longer use it. So you can imagine that no data set would ever be usable because it clashes against the GDPR. So I'm not saying that this kills the law, but these are certain aspects of the law that need to be worked out in order for it to be more robust and more consistent. Okay? Another problem. Well, problem, another issue, and this is the last one, has to do with the transparency and information to the user. Okay? So at some point, the law mentioned something that the operation should be sufficiently transparent to enable users to interpret the system's output. Okay? There's a big issue here about what it means to interpret the system's output. Okay? Because one of the key aspects about artificial intelligence has to do with explainability. Can the system explain how it achieved its results? And it is well known by everyone doing research and involved in AI that for certain classes of AI-based systems, namely most of the ones that put AI in the map over the last few years, the ones based on neural networks and deep learning, you've all heard about this, I'm sure, none of these systems has the ability to produce justifications about their output. None of them. And it's not a matter that the company didn't want to program them to be. No, it's just a feature, a characteristic of the system itself. Okay? The system will tell you this is a classification or this is what you should do, but it doesn't possess the capability to say why it was. Okay? So in some sense, imagine that you see a human being telling you, you should classify this. It's almost like looking into the brain of the person, trying to find an explanation for why that person said, you can't. We don't know how to look into someone's brain and find an explanation for that person's behavior. And the same thing happens with AI. So if this is really about what's in this piece of the law, is really about providing explanations, this notion of explainable AI, then this will just kill everything, okay? If it's not, if it's just about transparency of how the system was trained, what data was used to train, but not how to explain its output, then it would be okay. Anyway, so these are just some issues that if you followed it over the last couple of years, but if you follow it in the next few months, I am pretty sure that these will be constantly mentioned because they are points of tension, if you will. Okay, and again, as my colleagues were saying before me, this is only a proposal. Now all this political debate of lobbying is going to start, and it needs to be monitored very closely because it can change the good parts into bad, or it can change the bad parts into good. And we have to monitor it very closely. But as I mentioned before, I really think this will set the standard for what the European Union wants trustworthy AI to be. It will have consequences all over the world. And I think it's really a good thing because if it's not Europe to do it, no one else in the world will do it. And I'm quite glad that we Europeans are taking the lead on this. Okay. I think I took a lot longer than I anticipated, but I'm sorry.
No, I don't know if Eduardo wants to say something. I just have a note on the AI definition. So to give the proposal, to make the proposal justice, the update of the AI definition that is delegated to the European Commission, which is a way to try and make updating this legislative document more like a streamlined procedure, not having to not taking so long. Of course, as you said, it will still be and as we say in Portuguese, running after I don't want to do a literal translation. Yeah. Shooting a moving target, exactly. But so the instrument does provide these sort of streamlined procedures to try and make it easy for the document to be updated as it is said to be future-proofed because of these features, these updating features. Given this superficial overview, of course there would be a lot more to say. These are just the main features of this law. We could go on and on among the three of us, but we would like to open the floor for questions. And so if anyone wants to direct us, I don't know how deep are you into this proposal, but please go ahead.
I can start giving my opinion. I don't think the problem is the data, okay? I think I think people should own their personal data to start with, okay? So I am, there's obviously some, you call it failure. I think we're just reacting because we can't anticipate the future. Sometimes only after we see it can we do it. But so, two parts. I think the data should be personal, okay, and personal data should be our own, and we should have the right to be forgotten, for example, for companies to eliminate it. So that's one point, the existence and collection of data. But the different thing is what you do with the data, okay? And with the same data, you can misuse it, but you can also do very good things, okay? So I wouldn't want, or I wouldn't jump to this link between having the data and use it or misusing it, because they're two different things. And this is at the heart of the way this regulation is shaped. It's never about being fundamentally against that existing or owning data, or fundamentally against AI. It's always about how you use things. Okay. So with the same data, again, you can do very good things, but you can also do very bad things. The regulation aims at forbidding the bad things. Again, I have my own opinions about what is ethical and isn't. What I like about this is that it creates space for the legislator to say what's ethical and what's not ethical. Okay. On the top of my mind, and I wouldn't want the example I'm about to give to be very strong because I didn't think it through well enough. But I can imagine that having lots of people's faces, if you could label them as having skin cancer or not, they could be used for good, okay, to detect skin cancer in people's faces. But at the same time, it could have terrible uses. Unfortunately, many companies, and many of the companies that probably generated the interest in this, they don't have the ethical standards that perhaps we would like them to have, okay? That's true. But the problem is not really in having the data, but rather in how you use it. I can imagine many people not mining a particular company that is developing a system that people deem as being good. I don't think people would mind that company to have that data, okay? Again, the problem is not the data, but rather its use. And probably the same people would not want Facebook to have their data, okay?
Thank you.
I'm not sure if we could ever anticipate, at least the lawmakers have the capacity to anticipate such problems. Yeah, I know people warn about it, but I don't think we can ever expect the lawmakers to anticipate that much. In fact, only when serious problems come up, the legislator will act. I guess it's almost impossible not to compare this with the GDPR regarding the momentum. And there is a big difference, in my opinion. While the GDPR started before the Snowden revelations, the Snowden revelations made the GDPR what it is now. So there is it's very strong on the fundamental rights. You know, when the EU Parliament knew that President Marco was being spied, that gave them a strong motivation to be serious about it. And so in this framework, this framework doesn't have such a strong context. So they want to conciliate the perspective from companies and to allow and incentivize AI uses that they consider to be very positive, as Professor Zhang gave several examples. Just one final comment. The problem will be also the enforcement. So I assume most of we agree that GDPR is a good thing. The problem, and companies are required to follow it, but are they following it? In Portugal, for example, we are not sure. So, Comissão Nacional de Proteção de Dados, our data protection authority, in last year they issued no fines whatsoever. Well, it was not a typical year, of course, but there is a danger that with the lack of enforcement, these both the GDPR and this framework might be what Adri also calls exercise of ticking boxes. So the companies self-assess their own procedures, and they obviously are not the best position to assess themselves, but it's like this it's how these frameworks work. So yeah, maybe they are just ticking the boxes, but then they are not doing what they suppose, and it will depend on the actual enforcement.
No, just a note to say that, so this proposal also relies on heavy fines being imposed to the companies that do not comply, and which is a critic mainly from the United States, for example. They say that we will have a lot of compliance costs, but this proposal also provides for specific as they call sandbox regulatory frameworks to apply to so small enterprises. So these are, I guess, easier. These requirements are easier to comply with, I guess. As well as with the enforcement of the GDPR, it will depend much on the regulator, and it is supposed to be created an European board for this purpose for AI in European Union, but also I think it's the GDPR. CNPD, so the National Commission for Data Protection, will be in charge of this, also of artificial intelligence, and so to confirm compliance by companies. And as Eduardo was saying, there's also a critic being made that these requirements imposed on providers are, as he said, mostly self-assessments, and information it will mostly be provided to the regulator and not necessarily to the citizens that are using the artificial intelligence applications or products that will be used, for example, in software. So just some notes. And a final remark to say that military software is not under this proposal. So it's also, I think, a significant point. So go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, first of all, to the three of you for these different positions. I would like somehow to go back to the point made here on the fact that irrespective on what we are going to use the data, this means that first we'll have the data. And maybe most of that data would not be available for being used like this or like that, for this or for that, if there was a real data protection before. And very frankly, for me, the GDPR is a band-aid. Gives us with a nice feeling that we changed a lot, that we are not cheated. And visibly, we can see it at any moment. We go to hundreds, thousands of sites, even here in DC, what you can do, what you can supposedly authorize or not. Most of the people, they can't even be aware that first afterwards you have to look also for the legitimate interests and also check there. Most of the people don't do it. And in many cases, if you try to block this or that, then you get blocked yourself and you suddenly, by mystery, lose the access. So I would like to bring it back to the point in which already with the GDPR and now again, what we are missing, what we're going over, is the privacy by design. And this is what is going to be missing in most of this. If by design, because the AI is not a spontaneous creation by itself, it is created by someone, is formatted by someone, is framed by someone. So if there is no privacy by design in the beginning of all of this, then of course there will be amounts of data, which then we can discuss how it will be used, but only because it already went through all these, where supposedly there should be the filters and they aren't. So for me, there is the risk that also on this, and even more coming through the hands of a president like von der Leyen, after what everything which happened with her as defense minister in Germany, and which is, by the way, the reason why she moved to Brussels afterwards, that this will again be completely missed. And in some years, we will be maybe discussing another piece of EU legislation, because we already could move to the next step, and still the data is flowing, the data which is supposedly ours and which is supposedly fundamental right.
I will say that there is personal data and there is data that is not personal. So for the personal data, we have GDPR, so it doesn't change. Regarding all other types of data, and this is not my area, it's Jerome's area, but data is everywhere. So you take a picture here and you can extract from that lots of data. Everything we do, we say, generates data. So it's very hard for me to understand how could we hope to control how people use data that is not personal data.
Okay. No, I was just saying that we have had a discussion while preparing this talk on so digital literacy. What you mentioned about our cookies consent. So, after the GDPR, you do have to tick the box to opt in and provide your data in whenever you're visiting a website. But now, the thing is that we are mainly presented with the option to accept all, for example. And usually when we are consulting a website on a run, it's more difficult to be present and to think, oh no, this is not the button I want to tick. I want to go to the choose options or something like that so that I can customize my consent. And so this is obviously something that I think it's an abusive practice, but it is allowed because you do have to opt in instead of opting out, which was the prior practice. So per definition, the websites would get your data. So this prior to the GDPR being enforced, they would get your data, and you just had no words. You could just try and ask them to. As I said, opting out, and so just ask them, so I don't want to be in your database. And now you do have to opt in, but websites do put it this way that I think it's not very user friendly, and people do need to be not just aware that this will happen, but they need to, as I said, be sort of like present and at the moment being quicker thought enough not to click in the authorization they don't want to give. Another thing I want to say, it's regarding this proposal. So it does insist on the idea that data there should be public databases, right? And so they are sort of certified by the regulator, I think, or even the state. Okay. And so the idea that these data, and this is especially important, for example, for small enterprises that need to have that data to run their or to train their AI systems, to resort to these sort of certified databases that are sort of official and actually completely legal and not just created by private entities resorting to these practices, as I mentioned, with the cookies consent.
Hello. The question I ask is, there's this trend in sort of based on regulatory frameworks, both in EU and in the US, that most regulation for new technologies is extremely reactionary, as in the problem occurs and then we choose to solve it. I'm wondering, in your opinion, do you think that this proposal for AI is a reactionary proposal based on a reaction to a problem that's already exist, or are we trying to prevent a problem from happening in the future? Thank you.
I think it's both of what you mentioned, okay? So on the one hand, certainly there's a reactionary side to this legislation. It's because of certain practices that certain companies have conducted over the last few years, and the fact that they became very severe and in some aspects and became of the public domain, that set the trigger for the legislator to move forward. So that's one side, which is the reactive one, so to speak. But there's also a proactive side to this legislation, because even if what set up what set things up in motion was reactive, then this legislation tried to embed in itself this notion of trustworthy AI and ethical AI, which is at the very core of the research that is being done in the European Union, in Europe in general. So this notion of trustworthy AI and ethical AI is a very European thing. You don't see Americans too worried about this, certainly not the Chinese. And now I'm talking about researchers, okay? And this part is proactive in the law, I would say. Really set some guidelines for new companies that are now starting on how they should behave, how they should develop their systems, how transparent they should be in order to increase trust by the citizens. So in some sense, this law, in my view, has these two sides. One clearly reactive to what went wrong, but then I think it's adding some things which are which set the standard and set some beacon, if you wish, to companies that if this thing picks up, it's going to be quite good. Okay, because there's always a risk of this kind of legislation that it's going to simply kill companies and research in Europe and the US and Chinese will ignore it. But there's hope that it's not going to be the case, that there will be enough companies, and especially in the US, and public demand for some trustworthy AI, that the Americans would start want to have that brand associated with their systems, and then this thing really becomes global.
So just a quick note to say that the reactionary part is completely necessary, because otherwise, of course, if other countries have a huge advantage in development of AI and even considering the economical returns that this implies, we would be in a very vulnerable place not to try and obviously catch up. At the same time, of course, the way the European Union is doing it, although obviously, as we have mentioned this evening, it's far from being perfect, but it does set the tone for other countries. And we are still very relevant, of course, and you can see it just for the way that the US tries to hire talent from Europe, for example, that, and again, the way we created an artificial scarcity on data by putting the GDPR in force. The European Union is still very relevant, and by setting the tone here with these instruments that already worked for the GDPR, it, of course, may reroute AI development in other world countries or potencies. I don't know. You get it. Yeah. Thank you.